from 90.5 WESA. This is The Confluence. Getting the gas to market was the focus of attendees at the Shale Insight Conference in Pittsburgh this week. One industry leader says a lack of pipelines is driving down prices paid to local gas producers.
That erosion is a result of not having the infrastructure to gather that gas and get that gas to key consuming regions of Pennsylvania and of the broader market west, north, south, and east.
The economics and politics of the gas industry. After nearly 3 months off, the Pennsylvania legislature returns to session to take up pension reform, expansion of gambling, and tackling opioid addiction.
I just don't believe there's enough time to get it all done.
We'll talk with reporters about all of that on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. More than 1,300 energy industry representatives gathered in downtown Pittsburgh this week for the annual Shale Insight Conference. The focus or theme of this year's conference, getting the gas from the well to the user. We're going to talk about the state of energy, particularly the unconventional gas industry, with two reporters who attended the conference, and they cover energy and the environment as their beats. Marie Cusick is a reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania. Welcome, Marie.
Hi, great to be here.
And Reed Frazier is a reporter for the Allegheny Front. Reed, welcome.
Hey, Kevin.
So early in the conference, Marcellus Shale Coalition President David Spiegelmeyer tried to set the tone and rally the troops.
There is no bigger issue today in our economy than energy. It's driving policies, and I mean, these are issues that every American has on their front burner right now. They know that energy is a driver for the opportunities for Americans to be affluent, to create wealth, to create benefit and opportunity for our citizens.
Although David Spiegelmeyer was, I think it's fair to say, speaking to the choir, did either of you observe that it really resonated with those in attendance, or is there some leeriness, or they buy into that and the importance of it? Reed?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just him. It was a lot of folks speaking at the conference. Seems like the opposition to pipelines, not just in Pennsylvania, but around the country, has really kind of put fear into the hearts of oil and gas industry executives. I think what you see in Pennsylvania, there's a lot of local resistance to these pipelines. The Dakota Access Pipeline, the decision by the Obama administration's Justice Department to put a hold on that pipeline has really sort of kicked it up to another level, I think, for the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, Donald Trump's energy advisor, Harold Hamm, who's an oil billionaire, he spoke on the first day of the conference, and he said that decision by the Obama administration to temporarily halt the construction of that pipeline really just violates the rule of law. And I think that decision has a lot of folks in the industry concerned about politicians and regulators stopping their pending projects, too.
Spiegelmeyer also mentioned, in following up on that infrastructure pipeline issue that you two raised, when it comes to pipeline and infrastructure, the region is lacking to get the gas to market. And he says that that's driving up the cost for transporting the gas, and then driving down the prices paid to producers. And is this a competitive factor in terms of what regions are getting their gas to market, or what?
Well, I mean, we know that in Pennsylvania, there's a lot of gas, but there's not a lot of ability to get the gas to the folks who want to use it and buy it and burn it. You know, one term in the industry is the spread between the price paid in Pennsylvania for gas versus the price paid in Houston or New York City for gas. And Spiegelmeyer pointed out that the price for gas in Pennsylvania is now around $1.20 a unit, whereas in other parts of the country, it's close to $3. So it's hurting the folks that want to drill for gas here because they just can't sell it at a high enough rate. It's simple supply and demand.
And another big factor in this is the increasing share gas is taking up in electric power generation as coal plants have retired due to environmental regulations and just the market. Gas is taking up a larger and larger share of electric power generation, so plants need to get gas quickly, and that's part of the story of the pipelines. And I think the industry really feels like they make modern life possible and they help keep your lights on, and people just don't get them and feel like, I don't want anything, not in my backyard, pipeline construction. They feel misunderstood, and they were talking a lot this week about how to message what they're doing better.
And I think if I could just jump in, there was a real lesson for the activists who are against fracking, that maybe pipelines is really the place to oppose fracking and oil and gas development, because you really only have to defend, quote unquote, a small stretch of pipeline to really put the brakes on this whole huge piece of energy infrastructure.
Defend, you mean oppose?
Yeah, oppose.
Okay. All right, just want to clarify. Yeah, Marie, you were going to...
Yeah, and I think what they see now is they've said, the industry says, we always dealt with landowners and local communities about their concerns, but now we're dealing with a much bigger issue, and this is the issue around climate change, and they view it kind of as a ideological fight. It's these pipeline projects have just taken center stage and become part of this fight over our nation's energy future and global climate change.
Reed, do you think that the opponents will take note of that and say, well, let's not focus so much on what it's doing to our water or this, and it might be more effective to oppose it at the pipeline level?
I think that's where it's headed. I read a story the other day where activists are looking for their next target. There's a pipeline in West Virginia called the Mountain Valley. That could be the next, maybe not the next Dakota Access Pipeline, because that had a particularly sort of interesting backstory. It was near Native American land, and it was opposed by tribes out there. And, you know, there was this really poignant video on the internet showing security guards with attack dogs out there lunging at protesters. So, you know, I don't know if we're going to get quite that backstory to any of the pipelines in the East, but I think it's, it seems like that's where the new opposition is headed, not towards, oh, well, how is the DEP going to regulate well casings, or are municipalities going to be allowed to zone for fracking? But it might be, hey, it's the pipeline.
I want to ask a question that goes back to what Spiegelmeyer said and that you alluded to about the cost disparity and what the price is being paid to the producers, whether they're from Pennsylvania or from another state. And did that fractionalize those in attendance, say, well, that's Pennsylvania's problem? You know, if our producers are getting three times as much or twice as much as the Pennsylvania producers. I was just wondering, was there a rallying cry, okay, it should be pretty even across the board, or what?
I didn't hear that. I think the industry, at least at this conference, seemed pretty unified. And really, their problems in the downturn in drilling and the low commodity price is, as they will say, they've been a victim of their own success. They've produced so much gas that there's a glut, and now they're trying to move it to new markets.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about the Shell Insight Conference held in Pittsburgh this week. We're discussing that with reporters Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front and Marie Cusick from State Impact Pennsylvania. So for both of you, what is the state of the gas industry in Pennsylvania? Marie, you did a story, I believe in August, and you were looking at jobs being down, I believe, in the third quarter of 15. This was from the Labor Department versus the third quarter of 14, and new wells down. But the actual overall production of gas was up. So what is the state of gas production here in Pennsylvania?
Well, I'd say it's a maturing industry. You know, if you think about when the public really became aware of this in 2007, 2008, I mean, that's almost a decade ago now. And I think more and more people in Pennsylvania, local people, have gotten jobs in the industry and seen economic benefits from it. At the beginning, it was often folks from out of state, and that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But as you mentioned, jobs are down. As we talked about, commodity prices are down. They drilled a lot. There is a lot of gas here, and there's pretty much more gas than they know what to do with. So, you know, it's a boom bust industry. This happens. There's a lull right now. But I think they're very optimistic as they build more pipelines and infrastructure and power plants switch to natural gas, that this is a long-term thing for Pennsylvania.
Reed, do they know what they want to do with it? They just can't due to the infrastructure challenges?
Yeah, I mean, I think they have an idea. They'd like to be able to basically sell it anywhere in the world where it would fetch the highest and best price for them. That includes exporting to other countries overseas. That includes building pipelines to take ethane from the Marcellus Shale and make it into plastics. But I think Marie's right when she says this is a maturing industry. I mean, I think you just look at the numbers, the workforce has really trailed off, but the amount of gas they're producing really hasn't. So they're basically becoming a leaner industry. There's not as much sort of just cash being thrown around in the oil and gas industry. But, you know, they figured out ways to get more gas out with less capital output. So case in point, on my way over, back to the studio from the oil and gas conference, my Uber driver, Mike, if you're out there, he was a laid off oil and gas guy. He had worked in, you know, sort of a white collar oil and gas thing, and he got laid off from his contract job, and he driving an Uber. So I think, you know, and that's not, you know, I don't drive Uber a lot, but you know, I think you see a lot of stories like that where folks in the industry, you know, in the boom days were getting, you know, six figures, and now it's back to what everybody else is kind of dealing with the economy.
The conference is, of course, about the business of gas, but also the politics. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were invited to speak. Donald Trump accepted and spoke Thursday. Marie, you mentioned Harold Hamm spoke on Wednesday. Again, he's the CEO of Continental Resources, and he's an advisor to Donald Trump. He told the crowd that regulations from the Obama administration led to coal's demise, and he warned that a Hillary Clinton administration would do the same to oil and gas.
We don't want to wait with oil and gas until we're out of business to try to fight back. It's too late then. You got to get ahead of it. So we have to step up front now.
So is that a real concern that what has happened to coal, it will happen to gas? Or was it the fact that gas just happened to replace coal in a lot of the energy electric producing plants?
The coal industry will say they have a perfect storm of problems, one of which is stronger environmental regulations, but also it's the gas industry, too. Gas has become cheaper and has undercut coal. But certainly you hear concern from people in the fossil fuel industry that it is all about regulations and it's all about government policy. So, yeah, he reiterated that. But I think the big difference, and perhaps maybe the reason why the Clinton campaign didn't want to come for perception's sake, is that the Trump campaign really doesn't believe climate change is a serious threat. Harold Hamm has said it's not a major national security issue. Trump has said he will undo the Paris Climate Agreement that was reached in 2015. But the Clinton campaign obviously views this very differently and says it's a serious problem we need to address. So I think from the industry's perspective, this is just a big ideological battle over the future of energy.
He didn't say a lot about climate change. He certainly didn't think that methane leaks from the oil and gas industry were a big problem. Methane's a very potent greenhouse gas. It's the main component of natural gas. And there's a lot of focus from regulators, both at the federal and state level right now, about getting rid of methane leaks in the industry. So I think Marie is right that clearly climate's not an issue that Trump is really going to talk a lot about. He's frankly called it a hoax for the benefit of China, although he later said he was just joking. So it's hard to see what they would do. But in his speeches, in his campaign, in his rhetoric, he's saying he's going to undo all of the climate initiatives that the Obama administration has done. And those are some of the strongest climate initiatives we've seen in the U.S.
You both covered Mr. Trump's speech to the Shell Insight Conference. Has energy been a major point of his campaign prior to this, or was it just, okay, I'm going to target, here's my audience, so I'm going to talk a lot about energy?
He's gotten very popular in coal country, saying he's going to bring back coal. So I think that on the national scale is what one of the big energy things he said he's going to do. And so he's really gotten miners rallying behind him. And again, these people, I've talked to some of them in Western Pennsylvania, they often do point the finger at the federal government and think that, you know, somebody else in the White House could change things for coal.
And I think you had this really great quote in one of your stories was, people are going for Trump, sure, in coal country, but do they really expect Donald Trump to bring back coal? I mean, they're not stupid. But the one woman said something like, well, he may not bring it back, but at least he's going to try. At least he cares about us. And for what it's worth, he does make a show of being in favor of bringing back coal and bringing back steel to Pittsburgh. He made another comment about how we're going to help the steel industry when we unleash all this energy. And yet, I believe, was it the steel workers that backed out of sponsorship of the conference because of, or maybe it was the electrical workers. Anyway, unions have had problems with him. Maybe the rank and file in those steel workers unions are more in favor of him.
So union leadership versus rank and file percent.
Thank you. Yeah, you said it.
Okay.
And what's interesting about his speech, I've been to this conference before, and many of these folks are self-described. They're Republicans, conservatives. It's a pro-business crowd. I talked to people both before and after his speech, many Republicans who say, even though he got a standing ovation, they're kind of concerned. And afterwards, I talked to some folks that didn't want to talk on the record because they're not allowed to speak for their companies. But they said, I got different reactions from, okay, it was entertaining, to he's speaking to the national audience and not really to our sophisticated audience. So for one of the things he said was, I'm going to stop the EPA from holding up your permits. Well, guess what? The EPA doesn't permit natural gas wells. That's the Pennsylvania DEP. So just stuff like that, I think. Privately, people off the record were saying, geez, I don't know about this guy. Even though his message about helping energy resonated with them, a lot of people said, I don't know what I'm going to do in November. And I don't know what you found, Reed.
I think the bottom line is that he is of the party of fewer regulations, where if you're going to, you know, do a balance between economy and environment, he's going to come out 100 times over 100 towards the economy. And I think a lot of the folks that I talked to, you know, it seemed like they were mostly for Trump, although some, even, you know, this one guy I talked to said, yeah, I'm a Republican. I've always voted Republican, and I'm not quite there on Trump, which I found pretty interesting and just sort of telling about how this election has really shaped out.
Okay, 30 seconds, final question. What do you see in the future? You pick either the campaign and energy, gas, or just the industry itself. Your crystal balls.
Crystal ball? Well, I feel like this industry is kind of normalizing, especially in Western Pennsylvania with the addition of the Shell cracker. I think you're going to see, Democrats in Pennsylvania kind of, I don't know if embrace shale gas and fracking, but not be so quick to kind of side with the protesters.
I agree. As I said before, this industry has now been around in Pennsylvania nearly for a decade, so people are becoming more accustomed to it. But I do think there are going to be continued fights over these pipelines, because whether it's the people on the left and environmental groups who are concerned about climate change, or it's just a regular person who's having their property torn up, there are a lot of people affected, and I think that's going to continue to be a contentious issue.
Marie Cusick is a reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania. Reed Frazier is a reporter for the Allegheny Front. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The House and Senate are both back in session Monday to address everything from self-driving cars to pension reform to opioid addiction. But with just 9 meeting days on the schedule before the election, what can be accomplished? That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. From guns to gambling, from opioid addiction to pension reform, the Pennsylvania legislature has ended its summer recess and is scheduled to tackle some of those issues. But what can be accomplished in the remaining session days before the November 8th election? We're going to find out from Karen Langley, Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you. And John Misek, he's the opinion page editor for Penn Live and the Patriot News. Welcome, John.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
If you have a question or a comment, tweet us at WESA Confluence. Tom Costa is a state rep from Pittsburgh, and he told us he's not sure just how much is going to get done.
There's some bills out there pending that I think that are, you know, going to be pretty smooth riding. I don't expect anything controversial, and I'm hoping that we can end this session on a better note than we started.
Karen and John, is Representative Dom Costa right? Karen?
You know, I think that it will remain to be seen, as it's often the case with the legislature. He's certainly correct that I think the influence of the election coming up will be on folks' minds. You have all of the House seats and half of the Senate seats up for election. Sometimes, though, we do see some high-profile controversial things come up right before the election. So we will have to see what the leaders have planned for these few session days we have remaining.
John?
Certainly there are some priority items that are on a must-do list for the Wolf administration. That's addressing opioid addiction and the heroin crisis across the state. Republicans who control the Senate are fairly adamant about trying to get something on pension reform before the clock ticks down. But that's been a perennial issue and one that's been difficult to unravel. And given how many, how few days there are, it seems unlikely they'll be able to get there. But certainly, the leaders in the House and Senate and the administration have sketched out their priorities. But I think Karen is correct. Anything too terribly controversial will fall by the wayside. No one wants to take that on too close to an election.
Dom Costa said he doesn't expect anything controversial. But let me bring up a piece of legislation that some might consider to be controversial. The law that allowed outside groups, including the NRA, to sue municipalities over local gun ordinances was tossed out by the courts, not because it was unconstitutional necessarily, but because of the process. It was packaged with an unrelated bill. So the House is trying again. So what are the chances of passage before the election? And is this something that GOP incumbents might like to have on their resumes prior to the election? John?
I mean, certainly this is going to be the sort of the House's one bite at the apple at taking on the gun issue, which plays well with the Republican base before Election Day. The difference being, of course, is that you have a different governor, Governor Tom Wolf, who probably wouldn't be interested in signing that kind of a bill. If it passes constitutional muster, he might be in a bit of a box. But also, it's just a matter of getting that thing through the Senate. Again, this is sort of a controversial bill, whether or not the Senate will want to take that up, since they tend to be a little bit more cautious and deliberative than the House is another matter entirely. But, I mean, this is certainly something that makes for great headlines for the Republican base as we're, 50 days out before, less than 50 days out before an election.
Yeah, Karen?
And I would just note that while I would say that there is more Republican support, that it is not limited just to Republican members. We saw some Democrats voting for this in House committee this week. And, supporters make the case that it makes sense to have uniform firearm laws so that people traveling between jurisdictions don't have to memorize the various codes. And so there is some support in both parties for this kind of measure.
John, you mentioned that a different governor this time around. Governor Wolf has indicated he wouldn't support it in its, quote, current form. But have we heard what form he might support it in?
One where it disappears, no doubt. The governor has not been a fan of sort of these Republicans. And Karen's right. I mean, there is Democratic support for this. You have Democrats in your part of the state, in the Southwest, who are big gun rights supporters. As to what form would take for the administration to support it, I'm not entirely clear, but in general, Governor Wolf has been lukewarm to these sorts of proposals.
A week ago, Uber's self-driving cars made their debut on Pittsburgh streets, and we talked about it on the program. Now, earlier this week, the federal government, the U.S. Department of Transportation, issued a policy for what it called the safe testing and deployment of self-driving vehicles. The General Assembly was working on legislation regarding regulation here, and how does this affect that? Karen?
I think that we are going to have to see how that plays out. There are bills in both the House and the Senate to put safety requirements, reporting requirements on self-driving cars. And so, you know, I think that this is some new information that they now have from the federal government. I am told that at least in the House Republican caucus that there is some reluctance to just hand the matter over entirely to the federal government. And so I think that, you know, it's quite possible we'll see at least some action in the legislature on that. I know that that PennDOT has said that it also is working towards state-level policies. So I think that the states and the feds will have to figure out how to share that regulatory territory.
Is that what you're hearing, John, that some do not want to just rubber stamp a federal policy?
Karen is a bit closer to that issue than I am, but yeah, that's right.
Okay. So what are the chances of that legislation being passed either by the House or Senate before the election or even after the election in any days that they happen to meet?
Well, I mean, I can't speak to the odds on that, but I mean, it will have to be before the election. Right now, they're saying there's not going to be the customary so-called sine-die session after the election. There's no indication that might be happening. So in the 9 days they have allotted to them, they're going to have to take care of that legislation then. Maybe Karen can go a bit better to the chances of it happening.
You know, and I wouldn't necessarily want to put odds on it either. I would just point out that, you know, as we've said, there's about 3 weeks of session day scheduled before the auction. Obviously, it's a very complex issue. And if the legislature is indeed going to try to do some substantive work on opioids, you know, perhaps on pensions or on expanded gambling, that does eat up a lot of the time with which to deal with something as, you know, complicated as the autonomous cars.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA, and we're talking about some major legislation before the House and Senate and what could be passed before the election. Karen Langley is the Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Post-Gazette, and John Misek is the Opinion Page Editor for Penn Live and the Patriot News. A rare event is planned at the state capitol next week. A joint session will be held of the House and Senate to try to address the growing opioid crisis in the state.
I know that we can work together to make a profound and positive impact on the people of Pennsylvania by dealing with this issue before the elections.
Now, Governor Wolf asked first for a special session, then he opted for a joint session. Let's start with, what's the difference between the two? Karen?
So the governor's office, when they made this change and, you know, what kind of session they were planning to do, they said that a special session has certain requirements about timing, requiring, for example, bills to be reintroduced and special committees to be organized. And they said that by foregoing that route and instead of just, you know, putting bills through in the normal manner, that they might be able to do this more quickly without some of those extra rules. So instead, what we are going to have is a formal address from the governor to both the representatives and the senators. And then, I would expect a serious call for action for legislation to move.
Addressing the opioid crisis would seem to be a bipartisan issue, relatively easy to get something done. Bills have been proposed, but has there been a hang up on particular pieces of legislation, John?
I mean, there are bills. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is something there's broad bipartisan support for, and it's always sort of the sticking points in language. You have the governor pushing some stuff that would, for instance, that would limit doctors prescribing a week's worth of pain medications to patients, would require them to check a statewide database of prescription medication. Every time they prescribe it, rather than just the first time, we sort of cut down on prescription shopping and doctor shopping. There's one particularly contentious measure coming out of the House that would give preference to a course of painkillers that are much more expensive than regular medication. That's kind of seen as a sop to the pharmaceutical industry, and they're pushing that quite hard. So you know, as always, the disagreements tend to lie less in the broad conceptual stuff than it does in the actual nitty-gritty of legislation.
And Karen, what's the likelihood of the nitty-gritty getting worked out?
You know, this is an issue about which we have heard so much talk and so many expressions of concern from elected officials that I think I think it would be fair to expect them to get some bills passed and to not let this just be a series of speeches about their concerns. However, you know that there are indeed some nitty gritty details to these issues, and so we will have to watch and see what they're able to accomplish.
We're only talking about 9 voting days, I understand, remaining before the election. Let's talk a little bit about internet gambling and expanding. Doesn't the budget that's now nearly 3 months old count on about $100 million from an expansion of gambling? And that hasn't even been approved yet. So what's happening here and what's the likelihood?
I am told that there are serious talks and negotiations going on about what kind of gambling bill could pass the Senate. The House, of course, has already approved a bill that would legalize online gambling, permit slot machines in airports, off-track betting locations. I would note that the legislative leaders are saying that because a lot of the projected revenue that was put into the budget is from one-time license fees rather than ongoing tax collections, they're saying that it would be possible to put this off until the spring after the election and still balance the budget. However, they're saying that it would be good to get it done in the fall.
In our remaining minute, I'd like you both to address pension reform. It seems like there have been some progress toward this, so it was a polarizing issue. Okay, have to save, cut back on costs on pensions, but how do we do it? Have the two sides been moving closer together, John?
Well, back in the spring, or back in June, rather, the House kicked over a bill with the so-called stacked hybrid, which would move state, and broadly speaking, would move state employees, would keep the existing defined benefit pension, and then after a certain amount of income, move them into something like a 401k, like most cubicle dwellers have. That bill got sent over to the Senate, where it ran into some concerns about its fiscal stability and sustainability. The Senate is very serious about trying to get something done on pension reform this fall. But this is something that the legislature has been wrestling with for, 3 or 4 years now, easily. And if it was able to be fixed already, it would have been fixed. So to try to get something substantive passed in 9 days seems like a fairly optimistic lift, but you can never tell about these things.
Karen, we've got 20 seconds.
I think one change that we have seen on this is that Democrats seem to be more open to changes than they have been in past years. Perhaps that will make it easier for compromise to be reached.
Karen Langley is the Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Post-Gazette. John Misick is the opinion page editor for Penn Live and the Patriot News. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
From malfunctioning floodgates to lead in water testing kits, we'll be talking about those next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority has unveiled a new process to handle lead test kit requests. City officials trying to figure out what to do to mitigate flooding in Pittsburgh's East End. And last week, self-driving cars were on Pittsburgh streets. This week, the feds unveil an oversight policy. We're going to go beyond those headlines with Charlie Deitch, editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us in studio is freelance reporter Kim Lyons, whose work you've likely read in several publications. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have a question or comment, feel free to tweet us at WESA Confluence. So 2013, Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority came close to violating the federal limit for lead in municipal water. City Water had trace amounts of lead at 14.8 parts per billion, just under the legal limit of 15. PWSA offering free testing for individual residents or homeowners. But this week, the authority announced a streamlined process for handling lead test kit requests. So, Charlie, Kim, how's this going to help?
Well, I mean, if the streamlined system actually works, I mean, it's certainly going to help get the water test back quicker, obviously. But I think that the biggest problem here has been problems that have gone on at PWSA for years, which is in oversight and management, and not just on this issue. They had the issue with overbilling, massive overbilling, and the customer service there was just unresponsive and at times just downright rude. And so I think PWSA causes a lot of their own problems. So they may even have been able to get a little goodwill from the public had they, you know, on this issue, maybe a little, like the people wouldn't be so up in arms. But, you know, they sort of shot themselves in the foot on other issues.
Yeah, I think that's a really good assessment. They're all these unforced errors, right, that they could have been a little bit ahead of this. I mean, this is a very big issue. People are mindful of what happened in Flint, Michigan. They hear lead in the water. You know, they don't have a good sense of how serious is it, how much is it related, how does it affect me. You know, they look at Flint as kind of this example of everything that could have gone wrong went wrong, right, and they want to get ahead of it. But if the Water Authority had gotten just a little bit ahead of it, or maybe, you know, been more transparent, maybe that would have made a difference. But, you know, people are really confused and scared on this issue, and I think it's one that you have to get a little bit ahead of. You can't sort of react to it, I think, maybe the way they have.
Right, and so now they have these decades of documents they have to go through to find out where the lead pipes are. I mean, at some point, you should look at the fact that you don't have any of this digitized for 60, 70, 80 years or whatever it is and say, maybe we should concentrate while we have time before we have a problem. Let's start working on this stuff. I mean, we've put in public records requests for various things over there, and the documentation over there is just, it's just not up to date. It's not digitized, a lot of it. And so I see where the problem is. I think that the new director over there is probably going to, hopefully we'll go a long way to fixing things, but it'll remain to be seen how quickly it all resolves itself.
A quick follow-up, Kim. You mentioned the revelations in Flint, Michigan. Do we get a sense that more and more Pittsburghers are asking for these testing kits because of the concerns?
You know, that's a good question, and I would think so. I think it's not just Pittsburghers, too, that people with children who have, you know, they rely on public water supply for their water, of course, and, you know, how do you explain that to people, what the safety limits are and what the regulations are locally? I think that more and more people are cognizant that this is a very big problem, that if you don't address it early or if you don't catch it early, you know, by the time you get these levels of lead in your water, it could be too late to really mitigate any potential health risks.
All right. So city officials reviewing ways to mitigate the flooding in Pittsburgh's East End after rising water stranded motorists along Washington Boulevard August 28th. When the floodgates failed, the floodgates, of course, were installed as a result of the deaths of four people 5 years ago in floodwaters on that roadway. So what's the city doing? Inspecting more often? Repairing? What's going on here?
Well, they said that correcting this problem is going to take years and tens of millions of dollars. I mean, the mayor has said that. And I think the sort of struggle right now is between who is responsible for the safety gates, right, Charlie? I mean,
right,
correct me if I'm on there, but that there's sort of a back and forth about who is actually responsible for making sure the gates are operational and how they work. And I think that, unfortunately, that sort of level of maybe it's bureaucracy, that unfortunately results in no one's responsible for specific things. So there's that sort of problem to work out before they say, okay, why aren't the gates working? I mean, there was an incident in August where it was heavy flooding,
right,
you know, and once again, the gates were not working. So who is responsible for making sure that they work? Who's responsible for maintenance? That's very much the kind of the question that hasn't really been answered well.
Yeah, it's really one of the most infuriating situations I think that I've seen in a long time, because when you have a mother and her two children die in an automobile like right, they did, I don't know, if it were me as a public official, I would find out and make real sure that that doesn't happen again. And they installed the gates, and Mayor Ravenstahl at the time, I believe he said that the city would take charge of the gates, maintain the gates. But, you know, people say a lot of things and do a lot of other things. So it's, I think that the gates kind of got caught up, as Kim says, in a bureaucracy over who's responsible. But the problem is we still have this issue that unfortunately is probably going to hurt someone else. I mean, someone else could potentially, you know, next big rain could be caught in that, because it's, and maybe they need to start looking at a long-term fix, not just floodgates, but how do we fix that? I know there are some ideas and some plans as well.
Yeah, those ideas are going to be quite expensive. Yeah. I understand that some of the possibilities, some of the options are demolishing a police station, turning it into a retention pool, raising the roadway. That's where your millions are going to come right into play, Kim.
Yeah, and so you know, until they figure out who is it, PennDOT responsible for them? Is it the city responsible? They can't even begin to decide, okay, how are we going to pay for this? How are we going to, you know, what's the solution going to be? Because they have to really get that issue, I think, addressed before they can even start talking about how do we find the money? How do we fund this? What's the long-term fix rather than putting a Band-Aid on the problem?
Yeah, I mean, fix your Band-Aid before you. I mean, they have to do that. At least fix the Band-Aid while you.
Right. Yeah, the patient's still bleeding.
I mean,
right?
It didn't have batteries. They were turned off, for crying out loud. I mean, it's infuriating that this happened.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to get to, of course, last week, all the attention and international attention about Uber self-driving cars hitting the streets. Then this week, the feds want to set an oversight policy for self-driving cars. We heard from Mayor Peduto saying he's pleased the city will be able to provide input. Earlier in the show, we heard state lawmakers talking about heard that state lawmakers will be adjusting their legislation. What input can the city have here? What can they? Kim, you took a ride along.
I did. It was. And I've been covering Uber for, you know, a couple of years now. And so I think I'm not clear on what the local level, like what role you can really play in this kind of legislation. I mean, for the automakers, for Uber and for these companies, they're happy that the feds want to have regulations because they don't get stuck at the state level with all these different state regulations. You know, California wanted to propose requiring drivers of, you know, robot cars to have special licenses and have special tests they would have to take. So can you imagine trying to roll out this technology if each state has individual requirements for different drivers? Never mind different cities have different requirements for their driverless cars. So I think for the car makers and for Uber and companies like that, they're happy that there's some kind of, you know, proposed guidelines at the federal level. You know, whether or not that slows down the process further, it kind of remains to be seen. But, you know, this is a 15-point safety assessment, how driverless cars are tested, you know, what happens if systems fail, you know. And also expecting a lot from the companies, because a big question that people have is, you know, what if these cars get hacked? What happens then? And so the federal government's proposed guidelines are expecting a lot of input from Uber, from companies, to be transparent about here's how we're protecting the technology and here's what, you know, our testing and our research so far has shown. So I think it's going to be a two-way street to make sure there's information about how safe these cars are.
We have just about 30 seconds. What are you guys working on in the week ahead? What's on your radar?
Actually, as it would have it, Kim is actually working on our cover feature for this week for City Paper, and I can let Kim talk about that a little bit. It's on the city's 311 system, 10th anniversary.
Right.
Yeah, so this 10 years since the 311 system was implemented, it was the brainchild of late Mayor Bob O'Connor and has evolved through the years. And one of the fun parts of the story was the kind of goofy calls that they get, you know, from people who aren't sure who else to call about, you know, problems that they're having. So that's one part of it we'll be highlighting. But just looking at sort of how the 311 line has evolved over the years and become kind of a really big part of city government, how they get things done.
Kim Lyons is a freelance reporter. Charlie Deitch is the editor of the Pittsburgh City Paper. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Now, looking ahead. One story sure to be trending is the opening of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. It opens tomorrow on the National Mall. A number of items on display have strong ties to Pittsburgh. Tracy Moriello is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. She took part in a press preview, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Tracy Moriello, welcome to The Confluence.
Hi, thanks, Kevin.
When you went to the press preview and then wrote about this latest cultural attraction of the Smithsonian, do you go in with expectations? And if so, did your impressions meet those expectations?
It sure did. This is the kind of museum that I feel like you could go to repeatedly and have a different experience every time. One reason for that, I think, is the way the museum is designed. It's 7 floors, and there's ramps leading from one exhibit to another, and there are places with overlooks, so you can view the same exhibit literally from different angles.
With the press preview, did it get a lot of media attention?
It did. I understand that there were more reporters that wanted to go than they were able to accommodate. There was a pretty good crowd there. Not as many, I'm sure, as will be there on Saturday. So that was kind of nice to be able to view the exhibits without massive crowds of people.
A focus of your story, of your reporting on this, was about items of special significance to Pittsburgh that are on display.
Yes, there are several. The August Wilson exhibit, for one, is a real focal point of the cultural exhibit. as soon as you walk in, your eye just goes right to this spectacularly designed purple dress that was a costume that his wife, Costanza Romero, made for The Gem of the Ocean. And this dress has all kinds of pieces on it that are meant to represent parts of the African-American experience. For example, there's a piece of rope on it that's meant to represent lynchings. It's this beautiful dress, but it has all these sorrowful bits of history weighing it down. And it really struck me that the museum itself was really like that. It's this majestic building that celebrates the achievements of a people. And all of that is built on this really sorrowful history that's very difficult to remember, but also important to remember.
You mentioned August Wilson, and you think, okay, a piece of memorabilia, maybe a manuscript, a play of August Wilson, but there's a phone booth there from Jitney.
Right, that's there, and certainly the bigger prop piece that's there is the piano from the piano lesson, and it's really this intricately carved piece. A lot of the pieces in the museum are owned by the Smithsonian now, but most of the August Wilson pieces are on loan.
There are a lot of items from related to or from other famous Pittsburghers, whether it's a Hall of Fame receiver Lynn Swann or a camera from Teenie Harris. But you also reported about items from non-famous Pittsburghers, everyday people.
Right. It was important to the museum to tell the story of everyday people. And these stories were included in this bigger exhibit of African-American migration. So it showed both how African-Americans came over from Africa as slaves, but then it also showed how African-Americans migrated throughout the country over history, particularly after the Civil Rights Movement. So they do talk about a couple of Pittsburghers that moved from various parts of the South up to Pittsburgh.
Is it fun when history becomes news?
Oh, absolutely. It is. You know, there's always the convergence of the two, and current events are represented there. They had things from not very long ago at all. They also have the Black Lives Matter movement represented there, perhaps not as strongly as I felt like it should have been represented, but, you know, you got to remember that this museum has been in the planning for more than 10 years, and they're still adding to the collection. So hopefully that will become a little bit more prominent in the museum.
As a veteran reporter, were you impressed about including something that's very historical when it comes to journalism, the Pittsburgh Courier?
Absolutely. What struck me at first, actually, was part of the museum has an exhibit on the Black press, and of course the Pittsburgh Courier was one of the most prominent of its kind at the time when it published in the early 1900s. And it was not represented in that display. And I was like, wow, what's up with that? But you get a little further into the museum and there's actually, they have their own small exhibit that talks about the Double V Victory campaign. And that was an editorial and letter writing campaign surrounding World War II that the Pittsburgh Courier really started. And then it caught on, and Black press in other cities took up the cause. And the point was, it was an effort to end fascism abroad and racism at home during World War II and afterward.
Tracy Moriello is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. She took part in a press preview of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, which opens tomorrow on the National Mall. Tracy, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.
And this final note, Pennsylvania State Police and local authorities are encouraging caution amid a rash of public complaints and social media reports of people dressed like clowns acting suspiciously, even if they think many are pranksters or downright bogus. Real clowns, they're miffed, saying the bogus reports are hurting their image and business. Authorities in Greenville, South Carolina, were among the first to report a clown-related incident. Authorities found no evidence, not even a prankster in a clown suit. But for whatever reason, people in Alabama, Georgia, Maryland, North Carolina, and now Pennsylvania have since reported scarier, suspicious encounters with people dressed like clowns. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together. The engineer, Tom Hurley, production assistants from Vince Balestrino. Our producer is Marcus Charleston. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news and no bogus clowns.